CRJ 230, this is the week 9 podcast, or guide, I should say. I hope you're enjoying your spring break. It's a gray kind of spring break at Higgins Hall, but I'm still here, and I hope you are too. So this week we move to look at admissions and confessions. And in particular, we're going to look at false confessions. And I provided an article that I'd ask you to read, and also a case, People v. Macias. If you haven't done that, go back and read those two things. If you haven't read those two things, what I'm going to say is really not going to help you much, both for this week and then after this week into your careers. So go read those things and then come back and listen or watch this guide. So as we're looking at these things, these two concerns, eventually you're going to find a recent Illinois criminal case that discusses at length an issue with either an attempt to introduce an admission in court or an issue related to circumstances in which police are alleged to have obtained a confession. Without that confession coming appropriately. I'll share some of the history and some of the things that I've encountered in my career and some of the things that you'll need to think about, but you're moving into a much different age. Those of you that are both going into law enforcement and going to be looking for admissions and confessions, and then those of you who are going to work in the court side of things and trying to analyze what happened that led to an admission or a confession. One case per customer, same as it was the first 8 weeks. And you may not use People versus Macias. I shouldn't have to say that, but I will anyway. So admissions aren't new to you, because we headed into break looking at, our whole discussion of hearsay, what hearsay is, and then what hearsay is not. And an admission, as you know, is an exception to hearsay. So we looked at admissions in general, primarily as this concept relates to hearsay statements. And remember, an admission comes from a party in a case, not a witness. So in the context of a criminal matter, the party that the admission comes from is the defendant. The party in a case is the defendant in a criminal case. And so, we're focusing on how admissions and confessions cross paths or become intertwined. And we'll cover these concepts this week. An admission represents a statement that tends to prove guilt. On the other hand, a confession is a fully corroborated statement during which the suspect accepts personal responsibility for committing the crime they are alleged to have committed. Two different things. So an admission represents a statement that tends to prove guilt. And if you remember, the admission is something that comes from the defendant's mouth, typically at the time of or close to the circumstance. That's different than the confession that is corroborated by other evidence and comes after the fact. This distinction is important for legal and procedural reasons. For example, a theft suspect who agrees to reimburse the victim for a television stolen from a nearby apartment has made an admission. While a willingness to reimburse the victim from a stolen item is a good, maybe great, indicator of guilt, there are also occasions where a completely innocent person may agree to do so merely to help a victim out of such circumstances. Many of you may have done this. I have done this many times in my life. I have some extra thing around my house and somebody needs that thing because of maybe not from theft, maybe a fire loss or some catastrophe. And so you let somebody have or use a television, a computer. I've had some computers that we weren't using that in the course of this pandemic, a modem, some other things I've loaned or given to students so they can finish courses. Early on in a year ago, early on in this whole deal, and then as recently as, this semester. So you see what I'm saying there? That wouldn't necessarily indicate that they committed the act. The point to keep in mind here is that an admission does not accept responsibility for committing the crime, and that creates a major distinction between an admission and a confession. It's not uncommon for police interviews to result in admissions as opposed to confessions. A homicide suspect who states, I'm sorry, I didn't mean this to happen. Now that may be deemed to be an admission. Likewise, a suspect who after hours of interrogation acknowledges that he was present at the scene of a shooting. Under these circumstances, the investigator is likely to continue to pursue the issue further during that interview. And they do so in an attempt to see if the suspect will accept personal responsibility for committing the crime. Now, remember that often they are, hopefully, they have other corroborating evidence, physical evidence, testimony of other potential witnesses, maybe other suspects, co-conspirators, people that were involved in the act or nearby or saw or witnessed the act. Now, many suspects will refuse to go beyond that admission stage. They simply will not accept personal responsibility for committing the crime. You see that all the time if you watch any of the 48 Hours or any of those shows or, my favorite in the first 48. You see that where all the evidence makes it pretty clear and the suspect's own statements make it pretty clear that they committed the act, but they just aren't ever going to admit that even long after they've sat maybe in prison. So under that circumstance, the investigator must consider the possibility the suspect may be innocent of the crime, and they pursue their other investigative techniques to resolve that suspect's status. Many suspects who make admissions during an interview may be guilty of the crime under investigation. However, this is just less complete than a confession. So the investigator would like to conclude the matter with a confession, which the law typically defines as a statement admitting or acknowledging all facts necessary for the conviction of a crime. Admissions, typically, if true, do not by themselves satisfy all elements of a crime. And remembering, admission is one of our hearsay exceptions. Another person can testify as to the defendant's admission. A confession, on the other hand, is typically something that we obtain in a written statement, preferably signed by the defendant. Now, these days, even the smallest, and you've heard me say this before, even the smallest of our local police departments have the ability to record with video and audio a confession. And so, of course, having the jury be able to see that as opposed to have it in writing as we had to do prior to the ability to have audio and video is not as compelling, but we can have that. And it is a much better circumstance if you're that investigator. Um, A confession has the defendant's coming completely clean as to all aspects, all facts, all elements of the alleged crime. In my past professional life, I defended the state against criminal appeals over various issues. One recurring claim or issue in those appeals was that the alleged confession, or that the confession was alleged to have been a false confession. Now, this was in the days before readily available audio and video, the wired interview rooms, the ability to set up a camera in the interview room. Sometimes the undisputed actions or choices of the police, the actions I was in essence having to defend on appeal, were less than admirable or less than what a policy or procedural manual today, and maybe to an extent sometimes, in those days would have dictated. We aren't there anymore. In your career, follow the policy and procedure manual. Do things according to the law as you shall earn it this week. So in one such instance, the defendant contested use of his confession. Now the facts were as follows. Police arrive at the defendant's apartment and he opens the door wearing boxer shorts and a t-shirt covered in blood. He was by all accounts high and drunk. The facts that came, or the investigation that came after that, supported this. His girlfriend was in the apartment, stabbed multiple times, deceased. Now, his neighbors had called the police regarding a loud argument and screams coming from the apartment hours earlier. And there was a substantial delay, a few hours, between the time the call came in and the responding officer's arrival at the scene. The defendant was taken into custody. His bloody boxers and t-shirt were taken from him, and he was wrapped in a blanket and put in an interview room. You know, not unlike the interview rooms you see on the First 48. Now, likely, maybe not as nice as some of those rooms, but keep in mind, not wired for sound and audio. This is in the days before we had that ability, and we may have had the ability to record, because this case actually originated, I dealt with it in the 80s and 1980s. And the case, I believe, originated at the end of the 70s. There were recorders, tape recorders. That was a whole different technology, though, and they weren't readily available. So in this case, the defendant sits wrapped in a blanket in an interview room. He was kept in that room for well over 24 hours as two sets of detectives questioned him almost nonstop, essentially, tag teamed. And so one group would go off and they'd get their rest and food and whatever they needed. He was given food, water, and an opportunity to use a restroom when he needed to. He was eventually allowed to clean up, but then wrapped in a new blanket. He did not request a lawyer. He did not offer an admission or confession during most of that 24-hour period. He didn't say much. Now, remember what I said about he was in not by blood work, but by observations of things that were gathered at the scene, and by his demeanor and, folks who were police officers who had dealt with people who were both high and drunk, he was intoxicated on something. And by all accounts and reporting severely. So in the first hours of that, you can imagine what happens. He's sobering up over that time period. He was given food and water and an opportunity to use the bathroom. As I said, he's in his clean blanket, didn't request a lawyer. And he had been questioned over and over. Now, when you ask questions and you do that over and over, we've discussed the fact that you would like the individual to provide a narrative. And that's especially true with a witness, somebody who's not a suspect in a case. But when interviewing a suspect, it's not uncommon that you provide leading questions. In other words, questions where you give a scenario, hoping that the person will say, yes, that's what happened. So over the course of that period, these two sets of detectives had asked questions in that manner. And that'll be relevant here in a second. At some point in time, the suspect says, give me some clothes, some coffee, and a cigarette, and I'll tell you what you want to know. And that was uncontroverted. That was something that the officers who were present at the time said, and the defendant didn't deny that he said that. And he confessed to stabbing his girlfriend over an argument. Again, this was many years ago. Recording devices weren't available. In that case, there was plenty of physical and corroborating evidence, and it was a different time. The defendant did write out a confession and signed the confession, a written confession, and essentially not a lot of detail. Mostly said, I stabbed her, and over in an argument. So as happens in a lot of criminal cases, and this case came at the time that we still had the death penalty. And so what happens in those cases is that someone, while they're in prison with a lot of time on their hands, they will seek whatever appeals opportunities they have. This case was at the stage I had it represented by the appellate defender. The appellate defender made the argument that the confession was not obtained properly, that the individual confessed to things that the individual was led to know during the questioning, and the circumstances revolving the confession were inappropriate, essentially. I'm not sure, you know, in this case, again, there were plenty of physical and corroborating evidence. It was a different time. The conviction was upheld. I'm not sure it would have been today under those circumstances, even with all the similar evidence of the murder and the, you know, in the third district, depending on the panel that was drawn in particular. But today, you have the ability to record audio and video. Today, the policy and procedure manual wouldn't have allowed you to have someone in, you know, an interview room for 24 hours. Today, you would have given the person clothes. Today, you would have, you know, if you were convinced that the person was high and drunk, you would have waited till they were no longer high and drunk. So there's a lot of things that would have come into play here, but, you know, different time, different circumstances. So after reading the material made available this week and doing your research and discussing the various cases posted by your classmates, it will hopefully be clear that these types of things, the types of things that I just described, should never happen. with a lot of things in the law, reasonableness is always the key. Reasonableness is the backbone of the law. In fact, they posted I'm trying to do a series, as you know, people within the law careers, police, judges, lawyers, paralegals, people who serve the public through the law, we're not exactly, and police especially, held in a favorable light right now. But I think that most persons who serve the law have a reason for doing so that is legitimate and in good faith towards serving their community. I posted on the ICC law site a meme that I put out also on my social media that talks about reasonableness as the backbone of the law. That's something that came from Plato and Aristotle a long time ago, right? It's always been the expectation. Reasonableness is the key. Today, you would have likely had an easy opportunity to audio and video record that interview I just described. And even the smallest of local departments had that capability. So the moral of the story would be to use those tools, to use a little reason, to preserve any admission and especially a confession, and to know the difference between the two. Admissions are great. Admissions are something you would like. You know, compared to a denial, absolutely. They also may feed and help you get to the confession, and ultimately you want the confession. That's where we're going this week. Next week, we come back to the exclusionary rule, which we mentioned weeks ago. And we'll get into that a little deeper. You remember the map case, maybe? So that's where we'll head next week. But remember what I said, the second half of the semester is like a downhill slide. And especially spring semester, where you have weather improving, lots of distractions. Keep your energy level. Focus on these things. Because as we said, we started with the foundation. We built some blocks of your foundation in evidence and criminal procedure. And now we're building on that foundation for things that are going to serve you for the rest of your career. So don't let up. Don't let up. Keep the energy. Keep the focus. Find good cases. Present good cases. Remember to include the facts. The facts are the most important things. And then get in and take the time to read what other people posted. One of the things, the objective of having all of you find a new and different case is to provide that spectrum of examples that are going to stick with you in that most important of your muscles and the best computer you're ever going to own, so you can draw on those things as you move forward in your career. Stay well. If you need me, even on spring break, here I am in the same place. Take care.